Hi, I'm Colin Carr, remuneration consultant based in London. Like you, I'm passionate about remuneration and sustainability. And this is what I call responsible reward. Over the past 30 years, I've had the pleasure of working with global clients in financial services, energy, technology, and retail. I enjoy working with responsible investors and employers who care about how they do business as much as how much money they make, because they understand that one impacts the other. I'm bringing to you the Paying for Good podcast, and with my guests, we share our knowledge, provide advice, and tell inspirational stories on a different aspect of responsible reward every week. My aim is for you to become an employer, an investment opportunity, and an investor of choice to play a part towards achieving global sustainability goals. So enjoy the show and feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn to continue the conversation. Hi everyone. Today I'm delighted to introduce to you a new guest who is Simon Rosen from ShareAction. Simon's got a very, very busy job actually as a director of corporate engagement at ShareAction. And I was fascinated with the interactions that came his way during the summer regarding a particular pay resolution. So now that the AGM season is over, I'm really interested to and very grateful for Simon's time to tell us a little bit about, you know, what he does at ShareAction, what ShareAction is about, and also the purpose of filing this pay resolution at the AGM. So Simon, over to you. Please kindly introduce yourself and tell us a bit more about ShareAction.
Sure. Thanks, Karine. Thanks for having me. So as you say, I'm part of the team at ShareAction. ShareAction is a nonprofit based in the UK, but we work with investors and companies across the world, primarily in the UK and Europe. And our mission at ShareAction is to build a responsible investment system. So for decades, our financial system has been exploiting planetary boundaries, building a high carbon economy that is driving runaway climate change, and also fueling inequality within our society. So funding businesses that are paying wages which do not enable workers to make ends meet, and in general creating externalities, costs to society, which we don't pay for. So our mission is to build an investment system which is responsible for its impacts on our planet and its people. And we do that by holding investors accountable. So primarily focusing on asset managers. So the large asset management firms, names that you might have heard like BlackRock, like JP Morgan, in the UK, names like Aviva or Legal & General, in Europe, perhaps Amundi. And we first of all research and assess their performance as investors and as responsible investors in particular, how they are implementing policies and practices to manage and measure their impact on the planet and on society. We engage in public policy advocacy, which means we engage with lawmakers and regulators in London and in Brussels to try to create policy that enables sustainable finance. And then finally, the bit that where I fit in personally is that we also work collaboratively with investors. So we build coalitions of investors who want to work together to engage with the companies that they own on our behalf to make changes to their business practices. And we do that on climate, we do that on nature, we do that on health, and we do that on decent work.
Great. Thank you for that, Simon. You mentioned earlier on, you know, some organizations paying wages which may not be sufficient for people to live on. So can we just have a little recap on where we're at with minimum wages? Because there are different types of minimum wages, and some will organizations will continue to pay the national minimum wage, whereas others have signed up to the real living wage.
just explain to that, explain to us a little bit about the difference between the two.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And you're absolutely right that there's still a lot of confusion out there about what is the difference between a minimum wage and a living wage. And it doesn't help that here in the UK, the government has branded the minimum wage as the national living wage, which we'd argue it isn't. So a minimum wage is an amount obviously set by governments in law that employers have to pay. There are various different ways of arriving at what that figure is. In the UK, the government has set a policy that minimum wages should reach the 66th percentile of median wages over a set period. But effectively, it's an arbitrary number that governments decide, and it bears absolutely no relation to the real cost of living. A real living wage would be calculated based on a methodology which would look at what does it cost for an average family to be able to meet the basic needs of modern life. So obviously accommodation, food, basic healthcare, ability to meet sort of emergency costs, whether that's your boiler breaking down or something like that. And ability to save a little bit too. So the minimum wage not linked to the real cost of living, living wage linked to the cost of living. And actually, currently in the UK, there's not a great difference between the two. But what's interesting is the organisation that calculates the real living wage in the UK has just recalculated, and understandably, there's been an increase. Given the inflationary environment that we've seen in the UK. So whereas the minimum wage is not going anywhere and is staying at its current level, the real living wage will increase about 10% next year.
Thank you. That's really helpful. So as part of your work, you said, you know, you focus on different issues like climate, the social aspects of things as well at corporations and also through your investment community. One of the resolutions, and I'm sure you file many different resolutions at AGMs in order to prompt action and certainly debate. And that's certainly what happened in the summer when ShareAction filed a pay resolution with Sainsbury's. And I'm really keen to explore what happened, because quite clearly you received mixed reactions from the investment community, from the anybody interested in that particular topic. And it's really interesting to understand what prompted all these differences. So what, just remind our audience, what resolution did you table at the Sainsbury's AGM, please?
Yeah, no problem. So as I said, we work with investors to try to encourage them to take action on important environmental and societal issues. And in this case, a decent work and living wages. And what action can investors take? Well, they, as the shareholders in companies, effectively the owners in companies, can engage with them and make asks of them. As an owner in a company, you have a share and a voice in how that company is managed. And investors do that in a number of different ways. They can ask questions at annual general meetings, they can write letters, they can have meetings. And one of the sectors of the economy, which is has a large number of low-paid workers here in the UK at least, is retail. And one of the largest parts of that, of course, is grocery retail and the supermarkets in particular. And our investor coalition, we call it the Good Work Coalition. It's got about 40 different investors in it of various different shapes and sizes. Some of them are asset owners, pension funds, charitable investors. Some of them are big asset managers, those companies I mentioned that are managing our investments for us. That coalition, have been engaging with supermarkets for about 10 years, making asks that they become accredited living wage employers. So that means that those supermarkets would commit to pay real living wage rates as calculated by the Living Wage Commission here in the UK, the ones I was talking about, which are based on the real cost of living. And they do so for workers in their direct operations. But whether they are employees or whether they are employed as contractors. And I mentioned that because it became a significant point in the resolution, and I'll come back and talk about that in a minute. So we've been engaging, our investors have been engaging for a decade with supermarkets. In that time, the number of companies across the FTSE 100, that's the list of the 100 biggest companies in the UK economy listed on the London Stock Exchange, the 100 biggest companies have increased. So when we started this work, two of those companies paid living wages. And today, 51 pay living wages. So it's fantastic that we've seen that increase from 2 to 51 of the world, the UK's largest companies being living wage employers. By the way, I should say there are 11,500 companies in the UK that are accredited living wage employers. Obviously, many of them small and medium-sized businesses, but that's about one third of the UK workforce now covered by real living wage commitments, which is terrific. But to go back to supermarkets, they're a persistent payer of poverty wages. They thrive and they exist. Their business model survives on paying low wages. So we encouraged our investor coalition to escalate its engagement. And there are a number of ways that shareholders can do that. But one of them is to file what is called a shareholder resolution, which is effectively a motion being put forward at the company's AGM. So it calls on the company to do something, and all of the shareholders get to vote on it. So it's a bit of technical sort of corporate governance process. But we did this. We pulled together a coalition of about 12 large institutional investors, including Legal & General Investment Management, the UK's largest asset manager, including Nest, which is the UK's largest defined contribution pension scheme, and along with a number of other institutions, and more than 100 individuals from across the UK, individuals who are shop workers, who are customers, who are campaigners on poverty, each bought individual shares. They bought one share in Sainsbury's, the supermarket that we chose to target, and it cost them £3.50 or whatever the cost of a share was. I can't quite remember. And we all came together, this large group of individuals and institutional co-filers, and we filed a shareholder resolution calling on Sainsbury's to become an accredited living wage employer. And that would have meant that Sainsbury's would have to pay all the workers in its direct operations, whether employees or contractors, the real living wage, and to commit to meet that going forward. And like I say, 11,500 companies across the UK have done it. 51 out of the 100 FTSE 100 companies have done it, but none of the supermarkets in the UK have done that. And it proved divisive. So oftentimes when you file a shareholder resolution, you then enter into a period of negotiation with the company, and the company makes some concessions, and the shareholders who've brought forward the resolution make some concessions, and there's a sort of negotiated outcome to that shareholder resolution. And in this situation, that didn't happen. Sainsbury's made one step forward. It raised the wages of its direct employees who work in outer London, who were currently paid below real living wage rates. So that's great. So 19,000 direct employees got a pay rise as a result of this resolution. We're delighted. And that's an important step that Sainsbury's took. But what Sainsbury's refused to do was they refused to commit to pay wages that match the real cost of living in the future. And they refused to require that contractors that work in their direct operations regularly also received real living wages. And I mentioned that before, and I come back to it now, because that proved to be one of the most divisive points in this resolution, was around contracted workers. So these are cleaners, security guards, catering staff. They might also be, you know, maintenance staff or gardeners, or the sorts of professions that work alongside the employees in shops, who are oftentimes not being paid at real living wage rates because these contracts are outsourced and the price negotiated down to the minimum possible. And
Sorry, Simon, just to be clear, these are subcontractors. They are not contractors employed by the supermarket. These are people in their supply chain.
No, these are people who are working in their direct operations. So the security guard in your local Sainsbury's store, the cleaner that is cleaning up the spillage in aisle 12.
Yeah.
These are people who work alongside Sainsbury's staff, but they are employed by agencies, security companies. They're not employed directly by Sainsbury's. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It just becomes a little bit more complicated, I guess, because they're not direct staff of Sainsbury's. I just wanted to clarify.
They're not, but Sainsbury's is paying the contract that pays them. And by the way, you know, we focus this engagement on Sainsbury's, but let's be clear that the same is true across all of the UK supermarkets. Yeah. So the same is true at Tesco, the same is true at Aldi, the same is true at Lidl. But we... I make that point and I emphasize it because that's what was the point of difference between what shareholders were pushing for, which was real living wages for everybody working in supermarkets, and what Sainsbury's was prepared to do. So having reached that impasse in the negotiations, we took to persuading as many of Sainsbury's shareholders as possible to vote in favor of the resolution. So it goes to a vote at the AGM, and all of the shareholders, the big institutional shareholders, or your pension scheme, any shares that you might have in an ISA or people who've got them through employee ownership schemes or however, everyone who holds a share gets a vote on these resolutions. And it's relatively rare that a shareholder resolution reaches the ballot at an AGM. It's the first time ever a shareholder resolution on living wages has reached the ballot at a UK AGM. So there was a lot of attention on it. There was a lot of attention on how were asset managers and asset owners going to vote. And it actually raised a pretty fundamental question for investors, and asked investors what their priorities were. What did they prioritize? Did they prioritize short-term profit maximization and financial returns, or did they prioritize sustainable returns over the longer term? Because the business case here is that if you pay living wages, you retain staff, you motivate staff, you get greater productivity, and it pays a return in the longer term in the sustainability of the business. There's also, of course, the societal argument and the sort of the macroeconomic argument that by paying living wages, you reduce inequality gradually over time on the systemic level, and that's good for the economy and good for society too, and that's a good that people who are the ultimate owners of these shares might want. And then finally, of course, there's the moral argument, but you know, we can just take that as read. At least I take that as read. But it called out and it brought out into the open investors, asset managers, investment companies managing our money who were prioritizing purely short-term returns, because unquestionably it would add short-term cost to the wage bill of Sainsbury's and other supermarkets. So in the event we were having, you know, being this being the first time that this has really been brought into the spotlight, we were delighted that we achieved 17% of the vote in favor of this resolution at the AGM. And when you consider the large proportions of shares which are owned by private individuals, like rich, wealthy individuals, or for example, sovereign wealth funds in other parts of the world, actually, of the vote that could be moved, that's a significant proportion. And so we're really delighted with that first step. Clearly, it's not enough for the resolution to pass. You need to reach 75% for the resolution to pass. But we're really hopeful that year on year we'll build on this going forward, that the issue is now on investors' radars and they know that society is watching and expecting them to consider issues like living wages and the impact that companies have on inequality in our societies.
Yes, no, I understand. What's really interesting as well is that I'm sure that all of these investors are signatories of the UNPRI, the UN Principles for Responsible Investments, which quite clearly call out for responsible investment, which is exactly what they stand for. So real wages are certainly part of it. I'd like to go back to is the point about accreditation, because quite clearly one of the arguments that was put forward was, well, you know, we're already doing it. And sometimes I hear that from companies. It's like, you know, I don't want to tie myself to a third party, level of pay. So I just want to retain the flexibility and we're already paying. So why should we become accredited? So can you just explain a little bit about the importance of being an accredited organization?
Yeah, and by accredited in this case, we mean accrediting with the Living Wage Foundation. The Living Wage Foundation is an organization in its own right, a nonprofit in its own right. We work, you know, in partnership with them, but we don't speak for them. But I can say why we think that accreditation is important. I mean, the first part of accreditation is that you are meeting the standard. So the standard in this case is you are paying the real living wage calculated by the Living Wage Commission based on this open source methodology that I've talked about for your employees and subcontracted workers in your direct operations. That's the standard. So the first part of accreditation for me is it's got a standard associated with it. And you say that you're meeting it. So you could say, well, look, okay, I meet that standard. I'm paying the real living wage as you've calculated by the Real Living Wage Commission. And I do that for my employees and for the other workers that are in my operations. Great, you meet that standard. And then I'd say, well, you meet it today, but the cost of living is increasing rapidly right now, as we all painfully know. How do your employees, your workers, have any assurance that they're going to be able to meet their basic needs in the months ahead? So by accrediting, you send a signal to your employees that you are committed to doing this going forward, and it gives them security and it gives them assurance that they will have that going forward. It also sends a signal to your investors, and they know that you are committed to sustainably operating, responsibly operating in the future and not just in the short term. And finally, leading businesses by doing this are helping to build the movement. They're helping to build the movement and signal to the broader economy that living wages is a critical part of our society. You mentioned UNPRI. I mean, from a UN perspective, you know, living wages are also enshrined in international human rights. And so it helps build that movement, build recognition of what a living wage is. To go back to your first ever question, the difference between minimum wages and living wages. And it allows businesses to help build that movement. The Living Wage Foundation talk about themselves as a movement and how they seek their members to help build that movement going forward.
Yeah, and as you say, you received mixed feedback from investors. So some were very supportive, some were very vocal, like Schroders, for instance, very vocal as to why this resolution should not pass. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think that's as well as addressing the incredibly important issue of low pay and inequality in our society. The reason that Share Action exists and we do this work is to highlight the shortcomings and the gap in where our investment system is today, and that there are investors out there, large institutional investors who are operating in a way that is fundamentally not sustainable, that is exploiting planetary boundaries, and that's undermining the foundation of our society. So if this resolution served to put them in the spotlight so that people know who is really committed to investing responsibly and who is just talking about it, sometimes called greenwashing or ESG washing. I don't know if you'd call it living wage washing in this case, but yeah. I'm really disappointed that Schroders chose not to vote in favor of the resolution. They talk a lot about the importance of living wages. They have set out an engagement blueprint. It's a document they call, which talks about the expectations they have of companies in different sectors. And one of those expectations, very clearly, is that companies should pay living wages to their employees and to other workers in their direct operations. That's exactly what this resolution called for. And so I just can't get my head around why a firm that is committed to living wages, that is committed to that as a specific outcome in its engagement blueprint, thought that it was better to not support this resolution. So I'm delighted that, you know, I keep learning day in, we're still doing the research to find out who voted in favor, who didn't, to work out where that support base is. It's not immediately transparent. You can generally find this information out over time. And later this year, we'll be able to publish a bit of analysis about who voted in favor and who didn't. I'm still finding out and being really pleasantly surprised by some organizations that you might think were, you know, more conservative, more commercially minded, more profit maximization, actually voted in favor of the resolution. They realize that this is, good for business, good for society, and of course, good for the people who are working in these jobs, the hundreds of thousands of employees of supermarkets and other retailers in the UK who've been on the front line of the pandemic, keeping food on our shelves and on our plates, and who, you know, deserve nothing more than at least a living wage.
Shining the spotlight on the 17% who voted in favour of the resolution. So quite clearly, I mean, 17%, as you say, was not enough to pass this way around. And you chose Sainsbury's this time. What's next when it comes to living wages and actually, you know, continuing this debate and making progress on, you know, the other 49 firms that haven't signed up to the Living Wage Foundation or the other two-thirds of employers who are still not signatories and not paying the real living wages? What are you working on?
That's a great question. So we're certainly committed to continuing to work on living wages. I mean, as we've talked about, the cost of living crisis, the energy squeeze that we're in right now means that living wages has never been more important. A commitment to understand, to know that you will be able to meet basic needs over this coming winter and beyond has never been more important. So the investors who we're working with in our Good Work Coalition are committed to continuing to engage with supermarkets, but with those other companies too that you mentioned across the FTSE 100 and beyond. And indeed, over time, we're looking to broaden this out. Living wages don't just matter in the UK, they matter globally. People in all parts of the world, particularly in the global south, are parts of the supply chains for our supermarkets and for other businesses that operate here in the UK. So leading companies today are talking about global living wage commitments. They're talking about requiring living wages, not just for employees, not just for those other workers in their direct operations, but that living wages are paid throughout their supply chain. Unilever, for example, has made that bold commitment and committed to do that and is working incredibly hard to bring that to life. That truly needs a movement across the globe to start to bring something like that to life. And we're very keen to support that. But, you know, really tactically, looking at the supermarket sector at the UK, yes, we're continuing to engage, not just with Sainsbury's, but with all of the supermarkets. And we'll be back at AGMs next year. No firm plans for resolutions right now, a bit too early to say, but something that we'll be thinking about hard over the coming months. And perhaps it's worth just mentioning, you know, there are other dimensions to decent work, at least the ones that we look at. We look at not just living wages and living incomes, but also at the security of work that workers have. And there is a standard like the living wage standard called living hours, which is about employers giving employees who work shifts security about the number of hours that they will be employed, as provided they want those hours, so that there's a minimum number of hours that they will get, and that they'll get decent notice of shifts and of shift cancellations, because the security of work, as employment models have shifted into non-traditional employment, whether that be through 0 hours contracts, through gig work or other such things, security of work is equally important to ensure people aren't in precarious situations. And finally, just to mention, Kieran, the other dimension of our decent work campaign is about equity in the workplace, gender and ethnicity equity. And we're running a campaign right now looking at the ethnicity pay gap reporting. So your listeners will be familiar with the idea that here in the UK, at least, gender pay gap reporting has been mandatory for companies over a certain size for a certain number of years, and it's really created transparency about where there is imbalance in representation in the workforce of men and women at different points and different roles and different salary levels within organizations. Anybody who I know who is campaigning to address racial and ethnic inequity in the workplace also believes that publishing ethnicity pay gap reporting would be a positive step forward. Not the solution. There's a far more complex set of needs to address, but it would be a step forward in creating that transparency. The government has held back from making ethnicity pay gap reporting mandatory, but we're working with investors to encourage companies to commit to voluntary ethnicity pay gap reporting, and to use the benchmark of the FTSE 100 again. When that was last surveyed by CIPD, it was only 13 of the FTSE 100 companies published ethnicity pay gap reporting, and we're determined to drive that up. So those are some of the areas we're looking at going forward, and where we're trying to get investors to take responsibility for their role as the owners of these businesses.
Clearly a lot of work to do in this space, and indeed, if our audience wants to check out some of our past episodes on the gender pay gap and the ethnicity pay gap, we have recorded a few episodes on those topics, so you're welcome to catch up with those. So very inspirational, clearly a lot of work to do for ShareAction, but you know, very ambitious goals of the organization. I mean, clearly, we've only got a short period of time to cover a huge amount of work that you and your colleagues are doing. So if people wish to continue the conversation with yourself and ShareAction, what's the best way of doing so?
Well, you're always welcome to reach out. You can find us on our website, shareaction.org. Though I'm sure you can just Google it these days. And of course, we're on all good social media platforms. I'm on LinkedIn, and everyone's welcome to connect. And if you go onto our website, you can certainly sign up for our newsletter. We're always looking for supporters, and we have thousands of people across the UK who are signed up as supporters. Those individuals do things like go to AGMs and ask questions. So we have every year hundreds of AGMs across the UK. We send volunteers who sign up with us. We train them. We find out what they're interested in, and we then equip them with a share in a company. We proxy it to them so they go and can go and ask a question. It's a really powerful tool to start a conversation. All of our living wage engagements have started with AGM questions. You know, sometimes we have workers from these companies go with a share that we've lent them and ask a question of the board at the AGM about living wages, about ethnicity pay gaps, about, it could be something completely different. It could be about health impact. It could be about climate. It could be about nature. So there's a real chance to get involved in something like AGM questions, but more broadly, just to stay in touch and hear about what we're doing, definitely follow us on Instagram, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, Twitter, of course, too, and join our newsletter on our website, shareaction.org.
shareaction.org. Thank you very much. That was Simon Rosen, Director of Corporate Engagement at ShareAction. I'd like to thank you very much for all the research and for your time today, Simon. Wish you well, and I'm sure we'll continue to work closely on these really important actions. And thank you very much to the audience for listening to us today.
Thanks, Corinne.
Thank you so much for listening to the Paying for Good podcast. If you enjoyed the show, then feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn to continue the conversation.